My name is Brad Holt, and this session is called Lutheran Spiritualities. The plural may strike some of you as a bit strange, so I want to talk about that at first. Many people have different understandings of the term spirituality, and in our present situation, I think there are three main sources for the ways in which we use the word spirituality. One source is the Roman Catholic Church, who really was the first to use the term spirituality. And early in this century, it combined two fields of study, ascetical theology and mystical theology, into what it called spiritual theology. And out of that study came the term spirituality. The Catholic source then is accustomed to speaking about spirituality in the plural because Catholic spiritual theologians discerned in the long history of the Catholic Church many spiritual movements in the course of its history. So, for example, most of the religious orders were described as having their own spirituality. There is an Ignatian or Jesuit type of spirituality, so that's called a spirituality, whereas the Franciscans might have a somewhat different emphasis, and so that is called a Franciscan spirituality. And so from the Catholic source, you have the concept that spirituality occurs with different styles, different flavors. Not everybody is the same. And it's from that source that I draw my plural this morning. There are two other sources of the term spirituality that I think have been particularly influential. And these are 12-step spirituality, which began in the 1930s with the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the attempt there to speak about overcoming an addiction in a spiritual way without turning people off by talking about religion or God or church. The third source of the term spirituality is the New Age movement, which of course if in its roots is very, very old, thousands of years old, but in our own time is in more recent decades. And this is a movement also which wants to disconnect spirituality, if possible, from quote-unquote organized religion. So those of us who are adherents of religions, we Christians, Jews, Muslims, and the rest of us, we generally associate our spirituality with our religion. But for many people who have either been injured by the church or turned off by us Christians in one way or another, they don't want to have their spirituality connected with Christianity or one of the other religions. And so you have the use of the term common in our culture today as a way of trying to bridge everybody together. Now, one of the ways of distinguishing Christian spiritualities, with the understanding that there are a variety of styles of Christian life, one of the ways of doing that is denominationally. And I'd like to recommend to you a book by Frank Sen, edited by Frank Sen, called Protestant Spiritual Traditions. Borrowing from the concept from the Catholic Church of a variety of spiritualities, this author describes Protestantism denominationally as giving different spiritualities. So the book includes chapters on Methodist, Episcopal, Baptist, Presbyterian, Lutheran, and other denominations of Christianity, describing their particular emphases. And at this point, I better mention before I forget my own book called Thirsty for God, A Brief History of Christian Spirituality. I'm going to pass it around, particularly for those of you who haven't been here very long. You may not have seen it. The bookstore asks that we pass books around that we are recommending, and I have to say that I do recommend the book.
Thank you.
We wonder if you did.
In spite of all my qualms and my awarenesses of its shortcomings, I still recommend it. I want to tell you my favorite book review that I heard of this book. That occurred while I was taking a shower one day with my handball opponent and good friend, and he was telling me about a group in Florida that had used this book for a discussion for 6 weeks in a Presbyterian church there. So he said their experience was that in the first two chapters, you invite us to get our feet wet. In the next four chapters, the middle of the book, you show us that this spirituality business is way too deep for us. And in the last two chapters, you say to us, you encourage us to say that we can swim anyhow. This book attempts to do, in briefer form, what the Frank Sen book, Protestant Spiritual Traditions, does in greater detail. This book attempts to describe Eastern Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant spiritualities down through the last 20 centuries, and also include non-European spiritualities. So it's attempting a great deal in 150 pages, but some people have found it helpful, and maybe some of you might too. There goes the bell for the departing people today on the early bus. Now, if we, for the moment, we leave the other denominations and we focus on Lutheranism, we might ask the question, is Lutheranism a spirituality? Lutheranism has a distinctive theology. Does it have a distinctive spirituality? My answer would be, it has a variety of different spiritualities, some of which are very characteristic of it, and others are more or less shared with a number of denominations. So I'd like to think with you first about some classic types of Lutheran spirituality, some more recent ones, and then invite your response. I'm not intending to speak for a whole hour here. I'm just supposed to prime the pump. And the best part of the hour is always the discussion. So please be prepared to speak up when I have my say. Yes?
Just a question. How are you using the word spirituality? What do you mean by it?
Okay, good question. Thank you. In the book, I define spirituality as the way we relate in four relationships. The way we relate to God, to ourselves, to other people, and to the created order. So this is a very holistic view of spirituality, which most writers today would like to use also. The term fits a need by giving us a sense of the same flexibility as the term lifestyle has. And of course, spirituality is to be distinguished from theology or ethics, but also closely related to them. That is, spirituality has to do the way I actually live life. Or to use Galatians language, the way I or you walk in the Spirit. Whereas theology is the study of concepts, doctrines, ideas, which underlie and interrelate with spirituality. And ethics, as I understand it, is the study of what is good, what is right and wrong, how you make decisions in difficult situations, what is a virtue and what is a vice? What makes for the good life, in other words, in the moral dimension? That's my understanding. Now, if you separate spirituality from either theology or ethics, and I suspect that some popular writers on spirituality attempt to do that today, then you are fooling the reader. I think that every spirituality has a theology or a worldview, an assertion about the nature of reality with it. And some spiritualities don't want to tell you what that is. And also, I think that responsible spirituality has to do with ethics. Because if spirituality is just about me feeling good, particularly me feeling good with God or with the powers that be, then it is, from a Christian point of view, irresponsible. So there's a social dimension to spirituality, I believe. Now, excuse me, I'm going on and on, but you have some idea. I would also like to say, beyond the four relationships, I like to say these two things, that spirituality is about experience, and that spirituality is about habits or disciplines of life. What do I do every day when I get up? What do I do every night when I'm going to bed? What do I do when I eat? What do I do at work? What do I do with my family? These habits or disciplines are also part of what I mean by spirituality. Now, notice that I speak here in a very generic way so that I can include spirituality from a variety of positions. But what I'm trying to describe in the book is only the umbrella of Christian spiritualities, which is only one umbrella among many among humankind. Yes?
The doing and the living, would you also include in that ritual?
Yes, very much so. And it seems to me that responsible Christian spirituality only occurs in community. And this is something that is lost in much popular writing about spirituality. So that you could speak, for example, Catholics speak about liturgical spirituality. And by that they mean a personal lifestyle which is informed by the liturgy. Or a Eucharistic spirituality. You find all sorts of adjectives, or an incarnational spirituality, all kinds of adjectives before the term, within even the Christian umbrella. All right, are you ready to go with me now to look at Lutheran spirituality specifically?
That's not an oxymoron, is it?
You've been looking at the beginning of my book, have you? One of the first sections asks the question about Christian spirituality, is this an oxymoron? The reason why the question generates humor is that a lot of Lutheran theologians are very much opposed to the use of this word, spirituality, and many people who use the word spirituality are very opposed to churches. So you've got two groups of people who would not like the term either Christian or Lutheran spirituality. But I defend it, and I think it's appropriate. Now, what we're seeking to discover in these few minutes is an overview of the styles of Christian life, the styles of relating, which have been characteristic of Lutherans. With the understanding that this is not the only way to relate to God in the world. Martin Luther himself was a person full of vim, vigor, and, dare I say it, piss. His language was very crude often, but his devotion was quite evident. And his own experience always has been a sort of touching point for Lutherans since that time. Some Lutherans have looked only at his theology, but those of us who are interested in spirituality try to look at his experience, how he actually lived his life, not just what he taught. And of course, they're related to each other. But some Lutherans have focused so much on what he taught that they forget the human being. Now, soon after Luther's death, now let me say another word about Luther. Presumably you have heard that he began his life seeking very hard to please God. And he found that this was a dead end. He always felt guilty about even his best efforts. And it wasn't until he discovered in the letters of Paul that God justifies the unrighteous, the ungodly, that his heart came to rest. He formulated this in the doctrine called justification by grace, that is, not by merit, through faith, or in other words, through trust in Jesus Christ. And that became the touchstone for all his decisions about liturgy, church structure, ethics, and spirituality. We can talk a lot more about Luther if you'd like, but I want to move on beyond Luther here. You see on the board behind me, I have spaces for three classic Lutheran spiritualities, and we'll give these the names confessional, pietist, and rationalist. Very roughly speaking, the confessional period of Lutheran history was the 16th century, the half of the century after Luther died. Lutheranism was under a great deal of pressure from Catholicism and other Protestants, and the result was that Lutherans tried to state their positions and overcome their own disagreements in the form of confessions or official statements of faith. Now, the earliest of these in the Lutheran Book of Concord is the Augsburg Confession, which, of course, was written before Luther's death. But later in the century, you get Lutherans discussing finer and finer points of theology. And the tendency comes that Lutherans who had rejected Roman Catholic scholasticism develop their own kind of scholasticism. Like the Catholics, they adopt Aristotle as their basic philosophical vehicle, and they go into more and more issues, and finally, in 1580, they produce the Formula of Concord, which states their way of getting together and stating where they are as a denomination. Now, during this confessional period, people in the pulpit were very much concerned to show that Lutheranism was true. Pure doctrine was the aim of this kind of spirituality. This was a spirituality which called for intellectual work on the Bible, drawing out the doctrines from the Bible, and finding the exact doctrine which may be different from those on the left or on the right, and giving justification for it by a string of Bible verses and or philosophical references. The preachers in this period of time tended to spend their sermons showing 10 reasons why Lutherans are right and Catholics are wrong, for example. And they would also give lots of Latin quotations to back up their points to show that they were scholarly preachers. And the people sitting in the audience in the congregation couldn't understand a word, but they were impressed that their preacher was learned anyhow. Now, this is a period of time in which Lutheranism focuses on the objective side of Christianity, what is outside my feelings or perceptions. The objective Word of God as found in the Bible, and the objective sacraments which in baptism save me, and in the Lord's Supper forgive me. However, there came to be dissatisfaction with this type of Lutheranism. It was relatively cold emotionally. It was highly rigorous intellectually for those who were involved. It did have a strong sense of justification by grace, and there were some devotional books written to emphasize that theme. Now, the Pietists, who were led by a man named Spener, said, wait a minute, Christianity is not just about doctrine, not just about bishops and sacraments, it's about the whole of life. And that whole includes my daily life and my emotional life, as well as my intellect. The Pietist renewal called for church members to know the Bible better than they did. In the confessional period, it was mostly the professional scholars who knew the Bible. In spite of Luther's translation of the Bible into German, and his intention that ordinary believers should read it, the Bible remained mostly a scholar's book. The Pietists said, what we need is a text study, such as happened in this room a few minutes ago. We need to have the believers gather during the week with the pastor to talk about the texts for that Sunday so that they can think about them, get into the text, and live with the text. Furthermore, the preacher should not just be impressing people with his learning, but he should be speaking in a way that is edifying or building up to the listener. And he should not spend his time attacking other religious groups. Ever since that sort of teaching came out, Pietists were always accused of not being true blue Lutherans, because they were friendly to Catholics, to Reformed Christians, and so on. And of course, the extreme Pietist, like a Methodist, for example, will say, I don't care what you believe. If you love my Jesus as I love your Jesus, we are fine with each other, and I don't care about the doctrines. And that sort of attitude goes down very poorly in the confessionalist tradition of Lutheranism. The Pietists had so many good ideas about renewing the church, which we more or less take for granted today. I'm sure the things I've said so far are things that most churches would agree to, that you can have small group meetings in the middle of the week for prayer and Bible study, for example, that the preacher should preach for the benefit of the congregation, that preachers should be trained in pastoral counseling and in preaching so that they can relate to the congregation. All of these sorts of things came out of Pietism. Two other things that were emphasized in Pietism on the positive side are a social conscience. The Pietists noticed that there were a lot of suffering around them, and so they tended to found institutions to help those who were suffering, particularly orphans. They founded many orphanages and schools for children who didn't have parents. And they also founded hospitals and other kinds of social amelioration institutions. Another thing about Pietism is that it was the first movement within Lutheranism to engage in world mission. Along with the Moravians, who had paved the way in European world mission, the Pietists were the ones among the Lutherans who first sent people to other countries to bring the gospel of Jesus to them. And this was a very controversial idea at that time. The Catholics, of course, had had missionaries around the world for a couple of centuries, but the Protestants had not. Among the first of these missionaries were Ziegenbalg and Plutschau, who went to India and did a marvelous work there, quite different from our stereotype of missionaries. They immersed themselves in the culture. They learned the language. They learned the religion. They spent many years with no converts at all. And the people at home said, "Come on now, come on. We need numbers." And these people said, if the Christian gospel is going to take root among these people, it has to meet them where they are. It is not our job to turn them into Europeans. It's our job to see how the gospel of Jesus meets them where they are. And they spent many years studying where the people among whom they worked lived. So these are some of the accomplishments of Pietism. But Pietism over the centuries came to have a negative connotation, and I presume that for most of you who have heard the word before, you've heard it in a negative fashion. The Pietists fell into some traps in spite of their good intentions. They had a very warm emotional life. They were very close to Jesus. But they tended to divide themselves from other people and to consider themselves more holy. And this was true not only because they attended the meetings in the middle of the week, but also because they decided that the things that most of the people in German society did weren't appropriate for them. So they did not go to theaters or play cards. They did not drink alcohol, and they did not smoke cigarettes.
How long ago is this?
I'd like to know myself. I can't tell you. But this general list of worldly pleasures, as they came to be known, came to be seen as a sort of legalistic approach to Christianity, which said, quite to the contrary of Luther's original insight, that you are set free by the gospel, this tended to say, you have to keep these rules or else you won't go to heaven. That sort of understanding tended to sneak in there. The Pietists were also relatively weak when it came to their understanding of the sacraments, or of the importance of the structure of the church. What was important to the Pietist was, how is your relationship with Jesus? And if you are in good relationship with Jesus, that will show itself by your keeping all of these rules. Now, this pattern became more evident when Pietism came to the Scandinavian countries. In the 1800s, Hans Nielsen Hauge in Norway and Rosenius in Sweden, and I'm sorry I've forgotten the others in Denmark and Finland, carried the Pietist movement to the other part of Europe that was strongly Lutheran. There too, the church seemed to be very formal, dry, and dead. There were university-educated priests who were far above their flocks, didn't associate with them very much, preached sermons that they could not understand, and all the rest of it. And so this was basically a layperson's movement. And Hauge, among others, was a very practical person about helping people in need. And Norway was never the same again after Hans Nielsen Hauge. Now, Pietism is the religion of the heart. Confessionalism is the religion of the doctrine. Both of these were criticized by rationalism, which is also known as the Enlightenment in Germany, particularly in the 1700s. This is the religion of reason. And it says, all these doctrines which the confessionalists asserted and the pietists accepted without much difficulty, their concern was not doctrines, was how do you live the doctrines? All of those doctrines are under question mark in rationalism, and the rationalist would say the individual reason is the highest bar of judgment as to what is true. Not the assertion of a revelation from God in the Bible or through Jesus directly, but what you can piece together. And of course, in those days, the whole world seemed like a beautiful machine, and everything worked so beautifully that God seemed to be almost unnecessary. Some of you know that the deists in America tended to think of God as a watchmaker who set the whole universe running and then stepped back. This is a very distant God we're talking about here, a transcendent God who does not meddle in affairs in the world. Specifically, miracles are not to be permitted because they would show faults in God rather than virtues. So Lutherans during this time heard sermons having nothing to do with Jesus or justification or communion or any of the things we would expect in the other two sermons. Here you have sermons about how to plant better potatoes. Yes, we still have copies of those sermons. The sermon was taken over by the agricultural or mechanical or industrial interests of the people. The rationalist had, in spite of these seeming deficiencies, the rationalist also had some virtues, however. And among these was, like the pietist, the rationalist was very tired with interdenominational bickering. And the rationalist asserted that everyone in the world really believed the same thing. The rationalist was very much against superstition. The rationalist was against angels and demons, for example. This was the emphasis on science. All right, now these three traditions of Lutheranism, confessionalism, pietism, and rationalism are still with us today. I'm not just describing something that happened long ago. These traditions have been passed down, and in the United States of America, they have mixed together a lot, and yet you can find them in different congregations. They form a sort of background for what might be more recent spiritualities, and here I think of a few, and you may like to add some others. There is, for example, liberation spirituality more recently. There is charismatic. There is ecological. let me add the one I mentioned for the Catholics. There is a liturgical kind of spirituality among Lutherans. And of course, I don't mean to suggest that these do not overlap. It's not that people are only of one type. But let me talk briefly about these and then invite your discussion. Liberation spirituality is not distinctively Lutheran. It grows out of the liberation theology of Latin America, which is largely Roman Catholic, and has been adopted by many persons of Christian faith in other continents. Liberation spirituality means living your life with the understanding that God and Jesus are liberators, not only from sin, death, and the devil, but from social and economic oppression. That the reign of God or kingdom of God involves not merely pie in the sky by and by, but actual human freedom here and now. So liberation spirituality is a very this-worldly, communally oriented kind of spirituality. There's a wonderful book in this tradition from Gustavo Gutierrez called We Drink from Our Own Wells, which is a book about liberation spirituality as opposed to liberation theology. Charismatic spirituality among Lutherans is not what it once was. I think the era of the 1970s was its strongest time. There were the beginnings of it in the very late 50s in through the 60s, and then there grew to be a national meeting, or international with Canada, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where I come from, every August, which continues. But in the 1970s, this was held in the Minneapolis Auditorium, and there were maybe 10,000 people in attendance at these meetings, and I was among them when I could. I was mostly in Nigeria during the period of the 70s, and I had my own sort of charismatic prayer group at the seminary where I was teaching, which turned out to be different from what the Lutheran charismatics were doing in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I was mostly influenced by Roman Catholic charismatics at that time. At any rate, when my family came back from Nigeria in 1981, we went to look for the charismatic prayer groups in the Twin Cities, and we could hardly find them any longer. The big Catholic church that we had attended meetings at, where there would be a circular gathering of 300 people and more for a period of 2 hours that went so fast, was gone. And now we found 6 or 8 people sitting in the circle in a rather uncomfortable setting. The Lutheran Charismatic Meeting has moved from the Minneapolis Auditorium to a local church and is much smaller than it used to be, but continues. Now, charismatic spirituality is one that draws on classic Pentecostalism from early in the 20th century. Its emphasis, like pietism, is on experience. It is on my relationship with Jesus. But what's different from pietism in charismatic spirituality is the emphasis on the Holy Spirit, on baptism with the Holy Spirit, on the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which include, among others, the gifts of healing and speaking in tongues. Hungry, intellectually trained Lutherans found charismatic spirituality very attractive in the 1970s. But Lutheran charismatic spirituality took quite a different tack than liberation spirituality and tends to go toward the right side of the political spectrum whereas liberation theology tends to go on the left side of this political spectrum. Now, ecological spirituality is that which we're experiencing a lot at Holden. It seems to me every Vespers I go to, Jeff says, well, tonight's emphasis is creation. It doesn't happen every night, but most nights you'll hear him say that. And this is a way of trying to go in the to bring Lutheranism into a more fully Trinitarian spirituality. That's what I would like to see. And you see, what the charismatic Lutherans were saying was, we've neglected the third article of the creed. We're so focused on the second article about Jesus Christ that we've forgotten the first and the third. And the charismatic movement was an attempt to revive the spirituality of the Holy Spirit. And ecological spirituality is an attempt to revive the creation side of spirituality from the first article of the creed. So an ecological spirituality is one that focuses on the world and ecological systems and how human beings impact it, and attempting to mend the whole universe, as Daniel Erlander says in Manna and Mercy. Of course, he borrows it from the Jews, who have also used that phrase. So Christians and Jews and many others, including New Agers, have a concern about the ecology. And finally, liturgical spirituality is an attempt to return the American Lutheran baptism, American Lutheran spirituality, to a balance between word and sacrament. Traditionally, our denomination has been influenced by the other Protestants who have been strong in America to emphasize the sermon much more than the Lord's Supper in our worship life. And of course, the sermon is very close to Lutheran concerns. It could never be thrown out. But there has been a renewal of interest in the Eucharist. And so my congregation in Minneapolis, among others, is one where there is Eucharist every Sunday, not just a long sermon. And many people have come to like that inclusion of both. Now, just before I stop, I want to mention that I've been speaking about Lutheranism in America. And Lutherans are not only in America. Lutherans are in Hong Kong and Nigeria and Japan and New Guinea and all over the world. The spiritualities of Lutherans in other countries are a whole nother chapter. And I tell my students that you think that Lutherans are people who live in Minneapolis. But they are not just those. And if you don't believe it, there are Lutherans who dance in the aisles. And I have seen it in Nigeria, where Lutherans drum and dance as a normal part of their worship life. And so what I want to point out is that spirituality is influenced not simply by denomination, but by culture. And these two things come together in various ways. Well, thanks for your very attentive listening. And now I want to give you a chance to talk a bit and raise questions and make comments. So the floor is yours.
When you were talking about the Pietist tradition, I was wondering if that was where Lutheranism began to interface with the United States, that if it was during that era that we were finding immigrants from Germany and Central Europe over here, Pennsylvania, for example.
Yes. Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, who is quote-unquote the father of American Lutheranism, Pietist. Mm-hmm. He had been influenced by the University of Halle, which was a center of Pietism in Germany. And though perhaps not everyone that he drew together to form the first Lutheran ministerium was a pietist. He was, and surely that was influential. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just could you walk out your four areas of spirituality, say as applied to the confessional, so we could? I need a little sense of detail in those four areas.
Thank you. That's a good question. It's probably to do it a proper job. I would need more time than we have. Mm-hmm. But let me try do a little bit here. From a confessional point of view, the main point is our relationship with God among the four relationships. And let me just say in as a footnote here, that our relation to ourselves and our relationship to the created order have been neglected in the Christian spiritual tradition. And only recently are we giving them more attention. So, you don't expect to find those two relationships emphasized very much in classic spiritualities. But in terms of our relationship to God, the confessionalist sees God as a very clear Lord and King, who wants human beings to follow the correct teaching and the correct ethics, and has provided the means to find out about them. So in other words, for someone like Johann Gerhard, who would be among the best of this tradition, his spirituality would include prayer, but study would surely be number one. And that study would include the use of reason, but reason within the assumption that God's revelation had laid everything out, and the function of reason was to coordinate or understand it better, not to create it or judge it as you would have in the rationalist tradition. The pietist relationship to God is warmer emotionally and focused on Jesus. The rationalist brings in more concern about the creation and the natural world, but not in the modern sense of preserving it, but in the sense of dealing with it as a significant part of one's spiritual life. In other words, the study of gravity or the study of plants and animals gets to be important as the human enterprise on earth. None of them would teach you, as far as I know, to love yourself, as I would want to say we should teach one another to love ourselves as we love our neighbor. At this point, when I say that, I'm arguing with the whole tradition almost. Augustine and Luther firmly believe that if you love yourself, you will not love your neighbor, and you will not love God. So the distinction between selfishness or egotism on the one hand and loving yourself on the other hand simply was not there until recently.
Another question. Given that Augustine's roots are Platonic, how did the confessional tradition latch onto Aristotle?
It seemed after Thomas in the 1200s that Plato simply was not as bright a star as Aristotle, because Aristotle wrote about so many other things, including empirical things, including the sciences and drama and ethics, in ways that Plato did not. Plato seemed a bit vague after reading Aristotle. And so you just wouldn't want to hitch your wagon to an out-of-mode philosophy in the 1500s. Yes, Bill.
And the Lutheran Church, like any sort of institution or organization, is in the process of evolution. Where do you see the church, the American Lutheran Church, I guess, to be specific, because that's what we're talking about, in this point of evolution? And is it a relative healthier place or unhealthier place? What's your sense?
Healthier or not than what?
Yes, that's a good question. In my sense, more capable of assisting us with our ongoing redemption and redemption of the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm not very hopeful, actually. I think that there are possibilities, but I have a sense that American Lutherans are much more influenced by their surrounding culture than they are by their Christian faith. Mm-hmm. What it takes to move them in large numbers is often somebody who has no connection with the church whatsoever. I don't see Lutherans studying spirituality or learning the classic disciplines of spirituality very well. I don't see most congregations giving much help to people in prayer and meditation, in journaling or a spiritual direction, in healing, as I would like to see. And so there are bright spots, of course, throughout the church. But the slow decline of Lutheranism in numbers suggests to me that Lutherans, like Methodists, Presbyterians, and even Episcopalians, have made themselves so bland, so identified with the rest of American culture, so lacking in a challenge,
right,
to commitment for young people particularly, mm-hmm, that the outlook is not very bright right now. That's the way I see it. Sorry that that's the way I see it, but I'm telling it the way I see it. Yes.
Is that the reason the Pentecostal, charismatic churches are growing? I see this in a church that my daughter now belongs to, where there is a terrific commitment on the part of their young people.
I think there are a number of reasons for this. One of them is that Lutherans, particularly where I come from, tend to be identified with certain ethnicities and have not had the sense, like Episcopalians or Presbyterians or Methodists, that we are America. Lutherans tend to be German and Scandinavian. And those Northern European cultures have kept Lutherans rather quiet about their faith, which we have wonderful humorous parodies of in Garrison Keillor. A Baptist knows that she or he is responsible for witnessing to their faith to everyone they meet. A Lutheran may think, well, if the pastor goes over, maybe. We, and traditionally in the Lutheran Church, have thought, well, we will have our children. And today we're wondering, will our children have faith? But we don't have the same sense of confidence and outreach that many of the Pentecostal and evangelical, quote-unquote, evangelical churches have. We have the word evangelical in our name, ELCA. But it doesn't have the fire. It doesn't have the spiritual power that you find in these denominations. Now, another feature, of course, is that the more conservative denominations can claim to give you clearer answers about things. Lutherans have this long tradition of colleges, universities, which confuse things. If you study the Bible a lot, you'll get confused. I don't mean to say that flat out, but what I'm trying to say is that the issues are not quite so clear for Lutherans and other mainline denominations as they are for someone who can look at a single verse in the Bible and say, that's it. No more questions, no more problems. So in other words, I'm saying that for most of us in the middle denominations, we do not have as sharp and clear a message. It gets muddled by our ambiguities, our uncertainties. And I think that's another factor. And there may be, you may have other ideas about this, but why are the conservative evangelicals growing and the mainline churches, not only the Lutherans, are slowly declining? Yes, did you like to respond?
Won't you find these different spiritualities, the emphasis on different spiritualities in different congregations within the Lutheran Church as well as in other denominations?
Very much so.
So the spirit of a particular congregation is determined largely by pastor, right?
Not only the pastor. The pastor has an important role, but the tradition of the congregation is also very important. And if the pastor doesn't fit into that tradition, he or she may have to go. Yes?
Brad, if you were going to write a pastoral to the entire Church of America, to the ELCA in the United States, and you were trying to encourage it and move it and growing in spirituality and emphasizing those things that you think are most appropriate to the challenge of the church today, both internally and externally, what would you try to emphasize as what would be more appropriate spirituality for us today that we could grow into?
Here's your second book.
Yeah. I'll take a year to think about that. I think you've heard some of the things that I would say. I think that Lutherans need experiences as well as education. I don't like to see books separated from feelings. I like to have both so that it becomes not dry, which the books will do to you, and not just everywhere, every fad, every high, as just feelings will do to you, but some healthy combination of them. And my feeling is that most Lutheran clergy tend to be much more bookish. And therefore, I would push toward the side that many Lutheran theologians would oppose, and that is the importance of experience. I hear this gospel of Jesus, but unless I experience Jesus, the Spirit, and the Creator, it's not going to touch my heart to the place where it's going to change my behavior. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, that question gives me an idea, and I just want to run it by you and see if it has some historical
accuracy to it and what you think of the idea. Maybe some in the group are familiar with the LBI movement, the Lutheran Bible Institute movement, which was a series of institutes, I think three or four, set up around the country to help the Lutheran Church in its commitment to help the membership of the church become more literate in relation to the Bible. My critique of LBIs has been that they continue to want to be of service to the church in that particular way, and that may have been a good way to be of service to the church 50 years ago. What strikes me is that what you're talking about here, this more balanced approach, helping the church to understand its spiritualities and to try to find a balanced approach, may have more to do now with the life of the Lutheran Church than biblical literacy alone. And I'm just wondering what your thought would be of trying to re-inspire an LBI movement that would be grounded in helping clergy as well as members to become oriented to a broader understanding of Lutheran spirituality.
Well, my first point is that I think that we still are desperately in need of biblical literacy. That the Bible Institute should not abandon their goal of making lay people who know how to read the Bible and how to teach others and lead Bible groups within the church. I think that this emphasis on the ordinary people as opposed to just the clergy is very healthy. But the question then becomes, what do you emphasize in the Bible? And if you get a series like we've had with Duane Addison the last couple of weeks, you're going to get a kind of liberation spirituality growing out of a close acquaintance with the Bible. And I think it's clear from what I've said before that the Lutheran Bible Institute movement grew out of pietism.
Right.
Its concerns are just the same. But it has to, the healthy pietism, and I think there's both unhealthy and healthy pietism, the healthy pietism is ready to go out and change and be flexible and have its impact on the present needs of the church and the world. Whereas an unhealthy pietism just looks back and gets very rigid and legalistic and doesn't care about anybody but me and Jesus.
Right.
So my point would be that the basic mission of the LBIs remains, but that perhaps there needs to be more open-mindedness to the variety of spiritualities that I have listed here.
So we need a Lutheran Experiential Institute.
What we need to do is to convince the preachers, and to do that by convincing the seminary professors, that allowing spiritual experience to be important will not gut the heart of Lutheran theology. Mm-hmm. Convincing them of that is not easy. Yes.
We've been involved for at least 20 years in the Curcio movement. The Curcio movement grew out of Roman Catholics, and the Lutherans also have a Curcio movement, at least in Southern California. And the basis of the Curcio movement is this three-pronged stool of study, which would be the Bible, of piety, which could be that personal relationship with God through Jesus, and the third leg of the stool is action, going out and making changes in society and so forth. And the three seen in balance seems to me to be a very healthy bringing this all together.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know nationwide where the Curcio movement, you know, stands with Lutheranism, but or the Curcio movement doesn't have to be the only way of doing this. But I think seeing this stuff all come together that way seems to make sense in our world today.
So I might have listed another one for Curcio or others, and you might be aware of others. I think we're just about at our close. One more comment?
This is a question, and it builds on what you said about experience. I think you'll see why. And the question is, how do you see the increasing number of women who are pastors and church leaders affecting spirituality for the future?
Spirituality is a kind of subject that generally women are interested in more than men. And I'm hopeful, by the increasing numbers of women clergy, that spirituality will get more attention in parishes than it has with men. Men pastors, that is. That for me is a hopeful sign. And many of the people I have met, surely not all, but many of the people I have met in the Lutheran Church who are interested in the subject of spirituality and knowledgeable about it are women pastors. Yes. So, thank you all for your attention today, and I've enjoyed the conversation very much. Thanks for coming.